Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshops. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Diverse Populations Participating in Decisions About Your Care. And today's program is supported by a grant from Genentech, and we really want to thank them for their support to this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd just like to let you know how many people are on the call today. We have over 125 people on this program today. You come mostly from the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have some global participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. N.F.N. Scout. And Dr. Scout is Executive Director, National LGBT Cancer Network, VP of Social Justice, the Torvis Group, Los Angeles, California. And Dr. Scott will be addressing an overview and definition of diverse communities, how being a member of diverse communities may impact your access to oncology care, treatment management of side effects and pain, and lastly, what to expect from your relationship with your healthcare team. Is your healthcare team providing you with equitable, excellent care? It's really now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Scout.
Thank you so much. I always appreciate these calls. Maybe it's just because I don't have to prepare a slide deck. That's extra nice. But I do feel like, you know, we get some good information here. So with that, let me jump in here. I am, just as an example, I'm a transgender white guy. And, you know, when I walk into a lot of treatment environments, I could look like a cisgender guy. And, you know, I'm kind of the race that's treated more favorably, at least in the United States. And so I have kind of a lot of signifiers that I might be that mainstream dominant group of people. But as a transgender person, my experience can be very, very different, including the way people react and respond when they realize that I'm transgender. So the first thing I just want to kind of do is we talk about this definition of diverse communities. It really is, honestly, if you don't look like most of the presidents of the United States of America, in whether that's your religion, whether that is your socioeconomic status, whether that's your race, whether that's how you speak the language, if you learn the language natively when you were growing up, all of those different reasons, then you are really part of one of these diverse populations that, of course, you know, in our perspective, makes this country and so many countries more amazing and so much stronger than if we are a monolith. But we do know that the truth is that there is a history of not necessarily treating people who are in the less dominant populations with as much equitable care as those who look like all the presidents of the United States. So that means that, unfortunately, as they say, YMMB, your mileage may vary when it comes to cancer screening, treatment, and care. So how is that the case? I'll use some different population examples, but we do know that for many different communities, that whether you're a racial ethnic minority, again, whether you have different religion, whether you have a different status of speaking English, whether you're a sexual gender minority, all those sorts of things, there's often reasons why these populations, when we experience the discrimination we experience in the first place, means that we're kind of preloaded with some things that may create barriers to even getting the screenings in the first place that we need to get for our cancer treatment. For example, you know, my communities have been really experienced a lot of well-earned medical mistrust because people have reacted very poorly to us in medical environments. And I do not know one person who has either hasn't had bad treatment themselves or has known about their friends who've had bad treatment in my communities. And so as a result, we walk in with a lot more anxiety over how we're going to be accepted. And that's the kind of thing that can mean that we sometimes, honestly, delay cancer screenings. And so cancer can be found much later in our population than it is in general populations. You know, we may have a doctor, a main provider we trust, but then when they refer us to a specialist, we're not as confident or secure that that specialist is going to treat us well. And as a result, that means that we could avoid even going to that specialist in the first place. So just from the start with screenings, there's a lot of different populations where we know that there's barriers to getting those screenings in the first place. And then, of course, if your cancer is caught later, we often have fewer options for what our treatment's going to be. But even then, when we start to get into treatment, there's a lot of different ways that our mileage can continue to vary. Just as an example of my father, who's a Black man and is going through his treatment right now, he kept being asked by the providers, "What is your family medical history?" And as an, you know, Black man in his mid-80s, he has almost no information on what the medical history of his family is because they weren't getting medical care. It wasn't the kind of thing that was passed on in their family, you know, lore and stories. They often didn't have information about that whatsoever. And it's the kind of thing that his providers couldn't even understand, right? So it was, you know, again, reminding him of the bigger and bigger gap between who he was and who his providers were and how culturally they'd been raised with some really different experiences, values, and resources that you can't necessarily get to. But then, in addition, we know that discrimination really can play, unfortunately, a big role in people's unrealized and unrecognized biases in how they treat you in the actual treatment as well. So, you know, just as I know that there's so many people who go out of their way to try and find doctors that they trust more in their treatment. And that's really great if you have the resources to do that. Some of us don't have the ability because we may not have healthcare or health insurance that's good enough to change doctors. We may not have, like in the queer communities, we have less social support in the first place. So too many people I know don't have anybody else to go with them to a provider's office, which means if you're thinking about then changing providers and you're faced with all of that information that you get during your cancer treatment, you may not have the resources to even think about changing providers as well. But then this carries all the way through, of course, to the idea of how is your treatment going? We again know discrimination can really play a big role in that. Like, for example, we understand that Black people are not offered the same level of pain management that white people are by providers. Again, showing that discrimination kind of subtly eking its way in there. In the same way, if you're not a native English speaker, you may not be treated with as much dignity, respect, or as much care by the providers, thinking that you can make as many of your own decisions. They may equate that with lower intelligence instead of just simply speaking another language. So there's a lot of ways that the way our treatment goes can really be pretty different. And what I really want to do here, and I know I'm trying to cover all this in 7 minutes, is to emphasize that one of the things that we understand that's very important and more important than you might guess, they actually did research with doctors showing that if you gave them a lollipop before a doctor engagement at another health provider versus if you didn't give them a lollipop, they had a better outcome from that engagement. And what they were simply reacting to was the idea that they were treated well in some way. So what we know from patient-centered research is that if two separate sets of people are given the exact same procedures, medicines, everything like that, but one of them has a better connection with their healthcare providers, that person has a better physical outcome. So if you're a member of one of these non-dominant populations, as honestly most of us are, the one thing I really want to leave you with is this understanding that if you're feeling like your provider is chilly to you, and that can be your main provider, or that can be your home health aide helping you get out of the shower at home after chemo, anywhere along those lines, if you feel like they're not being great with you and you don't like the engagement and the interaction, and if you have any ability to change providers, I encourage you to do so because you actually will be helping your health if you do. And if you don't have the ability and option to change providers, then please know you should be extra gentle on yourself because it's a type of harm that's happening to you if you do not have that respectful, dignified, mutually, you know, productive relationship with those providers. So we just walk away with one thing. It's that it's not the pills that matter. How we our relationship with the providers are is just as important. And so if you're feeling that chilliness, try and see if you can go somewhere else.
Well, that was superb. Dr. Scott, that was just a wonderful presentation, just amazing. And honestly, you set the tone clearly for today's program and have given people a lot to think about in terms of where they get their care and also how they're feeling that they're being treated. So it's really, I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi, and Dr. Chi is a clinical oncology social worker, author and researcher, healthcare disparities, social determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And Dr. Chi will be addressing what is cultural humility and how your care team practices cultural humility, how to self-advocate with healthcare staff, languages spoken, disability services, and other barriers to health equity, and health literacy, how to become more knowledgeable and satisfied with your care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Cultural humility is not a static state, something to be achieved, but rather an ongoing process that involves identifying, reflecting on, and critically examining our potential biases. What are our assumptions and beliefs about various cultures and identities? Culture and identity can encompass race and ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, education level, social and physical abilities. What do these concepts mean to us about ourselves and others? What is true and what is bias or stereotype? How do we approach these concepts with humility and curiosity rather than an assumption that we can know everything there is to know about all cultures and then the work is done? Cultural humility means asking ourselves, what are the different parts of my own culture and identity, and how do they affect my perspective on life, the world, other people? How does my perspective change depending on my current context and where I am today, in the hospital, the waiting room, the exam room, the treatment chair? Which parts of my identity are privileged or marginalized? How does this impact my beliefs and how I treat people or how I am treated? How does my healthcare team treat me? How do I treat them? Cultural humility is about continually asking ourselves a series of questions and not assuming we have all the answers. In the context of your healthcare and treatment team, this might look like them offering you written materials about your type of cancer or condition in your preferred language, or providing interpreters to facilitate communication about your health, them addressing you respectfully with your preferred name, or respecting your choice about how much info to give you or your family about your diagnosis. It might mean them not assuming based on your appearance that you know or don't know certain things, or that your family, partner, or caregivers do. It might mean developing a treatment plan that takes into account your religious or cultural preferences because they've asked you about them, presenting all treatment and care options, understanding how culture or identity may impact your health and lifestyle choices, options, and accessibility, and how to communicate with you and your loved ones about these things without judgment or shaming, even when they don't understand. It might mean considering your access or lack of access to healthy nutrition and exercise options and physical environments and resources, and being aware and mindful of all the various parts of you and all of your possible identities while also seeing you as a whole person. One of the things I just mentioned was language. Spoken and written communication is so important in making healthcare decisions. If you can't understand what your options for care or treatment are, how can you fully participate in the decision-making process? In New York City, where cancer care is headquartered and where approximately 800 languages are spoken, a study conducted by the University of Michigan and published in 2023 by the Journal of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network found that most Spanish and Mandarin speakers with limited English proficiency struggled to get access to even an initial appointment with an oncologist because when they called the general information line of various hospitals, they weren't connected to the cancer center, they weren't transferred to the right department, they were put on hold indefinitely, or even disconnected. This study just highlights how something that we may take for granted, being able to make that very first appointment in order to get seen by a doctor and get a diagnosis, can be a big barrier for many people. How can you get the information you need about your diagnosis, but also your treatment options? In this digital age, there might not be printed material on your specific diagnosis in your preferred language, but maybe you can find it online. Who can help you access that from a reputable source? Maybe someone in a library, a hospital social worker, maybe someone can print it for you, or you could call an organization like Cancer Care. Is there an interpreter service available at your hospital or treatment center? Even if one is not available in person at the time of your visit, they should be able to connect you to an interpreter by phone in the exam or treatment room. Tell your social worker, your managed care nurse, your doctor, your medical secretary, patient advocate, patient navigator. If you can't get through, make them aware. Speak up. Ask them to call the lines themselves to see what the problem is and what that experience is like. Regardless of the language that you speak or your degree of English proficiency, you need to have a certain degree of health literacy. Health literacy is defined by the CDC as the degree to which you have the ability to find, understand, and use information and services to inform your healthcare decisions. How do you get more knowledge about your condition and care? Decisions about your care and treatment are a two-way street, a dynamic process between you and your healthcare providers. So your satisfaction with them partly depends on how well you make your needs known to them, as well as how well they meet those needs. If you have limited health literacy, let's say a little bit of knowledge about your illness or a cancer diagnosis, but not too much, you may make mistakes when taking your prescription medications, or the team might misunderstand your symptoms. You may not clearly understand the treatment protocol, your chemo schedule, or surgery aftercare instructions, and you may end up back in the hospital. So health literacy helps you take control over your own care and health. This can help you answer things like, when do I go to the ER versus call my primary care doctor versus go to urgent care or call the oncologist? When can I get the information I need from my nurse versus the doctor? Organizations like hospitals and cancer centers also have a responsibility to be health literate, meaning they need to figure out how to make their information and services accessible to everyone on an equitable basis. Again, the relationship is collaborative. It's not one way. I know our healthcare providers are usually quite busy and they don't have a lot of time, but ask them the questions you need, and if they don't answer it and don't understand you, ask again or seek a second opinion or an interpreter or bring someone along for support that can help. Write down your questions and take notes, then repeat what you heard to make sure you're all on the same page. Ask them, can they connect you to a local or national cancer organization that you can call for help and information in navigating your diagnosis, something like the National Cancer Institute or Leukemia and Lymphoma Society or American Cancer Society, to name a few. Email or message them or call them afterwards for follow-up if needed. I do think most healthcare providers prefer that you take more time up front to make sure you understand and get the information you need in the way that you need it, versus you ending up sicker or in a health crisis. Now, another potential barrier to care is your access to disability services. If your doctor's office, hospital, or treatment center doesn't have proper accessibility, maybe the elevator is broken and you're not mobile enough to use the stairs, or transportation itself is the problem, ask social worker or nurse care manager for options and alternatives and how to access them. Who can assist you with this? If you have a hearing or sight impairment, how does this affect your ability to access information and decide your treatment options? Is there a sign language interpreter? Or are there visual aids that can help you read information? Also, if you have a cognitive or neurological disability, maybe a learning disability or ADHD, so you may process and interpret information differently, maybe sometimes with more anxiety, make your healthcare team aware of that. Bring someone with you. Support, again, is so key. Ask your healthcare provider, can I record this visit? And then if they give you permission, that's a great way to process it yourself or with a trusted loved one afterwards. Play it back. What accommodations can the Institute make, and what can you tell them to make your needs clear? So I've already mentioned some ways of how to self-advocate with healthcare staff, such as speaking up, bringing support, informing your team of your specific needs, and identifying who among them can help you access the information or services you need. And I really, again, want to stress that they want to eliminate these barriers so that you can get the best care possible. Your team wants to see the whole picture, but they may not have all the pieces, or they might only be focusing in on one of them because of their specialty, their limited time, lots of reasons. So you are part of that team, and you need to draw their attention to the parts that they might be missing. One way, again, first is make sure your providers are in network with your insurance coverage, or find out if you owe copay, coinsurance, have a deductible. That's part of financial health literacy, which is also essential to this process. Or again, write down the questions that you may have before this healthcare visit. Have a plan, have a specific goals for each visit. Do you need a prescription? Do you need clarification about a symptom or treatment? Keep track of your symptoms and changes and report them. Know yourself and your own health and medical history, your family history. This helps your providers to help you. Then summarize the visit out loud to your healthcare provider to make sure you understand and also know what are the next steps. When's my next appointment? Overall, have confidence in yourself. You know your body and your health best. And you can feel free to ask them why this option versus this. Are there other possibilities for this diagnosis or for my treatment? Essentially, you are hiring and trusting these healthcare providers with your care. So you're interviewing them, so to speak. They may be the expert on your symptoms or different diagnoses, healthcare issues, but you are the expert on you. It takes a village to treat this cancer, but you are ultimately the boss. Be respectful, but know your own expertise, which is you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chi. That was really outstanding. Just a wonderful presentation. A lot of wonderful material for our audience to kind of absorb and to utilize. It's so important. And so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Jaramillo, and she's an oncology social worker, and she's our Insights Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Jaramillo will be discussing when to seek a second opinion, finding the best care, how to request copies of treatment and pathology reports to your encounter notes, key questions to ask your healthcare team about your treatment plan, and how to access practical and psychosocial support from your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to bring on board and to introduce you my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sarah Jaramillo. Ms. Sarah Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction. To start with, there may be many misconceptions about second opinions, whether it's fear of offending your provider, fear of retaliation or mistreatment. It is important to know that seeking a second opinion as a cancer patient or as a caregiver for your loved one is a common and often recommended practice. It may be advisable to seek a second opinion when the diagnosis is unclear, treatment options are complex or limited, or if there are any doubts about the recommended treatment plan. For advanced cancers or rare forms of cancer, it is also often beneficial to get another expert's perspective to ensure all available treatment options are explored, including clinical trials. If you're experiencing persistent symptoms despite treatment, or if you've given a limited prognosis, seeking a second opinion can provide alternative perspective on the diagnosis and potential treatment options. And lastly, if you feel dissatisfied with your current healthcare provider, or if you believe you're not receiving adequate attention or care, seeking a second opinion can help you find a healthcare team that meets your needs and preferences. Finding the best care for cancer treatment involves several steps, and these are some things that you should consider. So first, look for healthcare providers and facilities with expertise in treating your specific type of cancer. So you can do this either by your insurance company, or you can also start searching online, utilizing search engines from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, American Medical Association, or the American College of Surgeons. You can also ask recommendations from your primary care physicians or other healthcare professionals that may have treated you in the past, or seeking referrals from support groups or advocacy organizations that may provide this service. You can also consider comprehensive cancer treatment centers. Comprehensive cancer treatment centers often have a multidisciplinary team of specialists who collaborate to provide the most advanced and comprehensive care. These centers may also offer access to clinical trials, cutting-edge treatments, and supportive services for patients and their families, including financial support and emotional support. Once you've found your provider, make sure to check credentials and experience. Evaluate the credentials, experience, and expertise. look for board-certified oncologists with experience in treating the type of cancer you or your loved one are diagnosed with, and consider factors such as patient outcomes, hospital rankings, and patient satisfaction scores. Evaluating communication and compassion can also help you determine if a healthcare professional is right for you. Choose healthcare providers who prioritize clear communication, empathy, and compassion. You should feel comfortable asking questions, expressing concerns, and participating in shared decision-making about your treatment plan. It is also important to consider logistics and supportive services. Take into account practical considerations such as the location of the healthcare facility, insurance coverage, transportation, and access to support services such as counseling, nutrition counseling, and survivorship programs. You can always look on their webpage to see if they have any supportive services, including financial assistance, or you could also inquire with the oncologist directly to see if they provide you with referrals or share more about supportive services that they offer. And if you're thinking about transferring to a different treatment team, or if you just have questions about your treatment or pathology reports, it is important for you to know that you have the right to access your medical records. Additionally, this can be useful information when you're looking to better understand your treatments or diagnoses or manage any administrative tasks such as insurance claims, taxes, and other legal matters. Requesting copies of your treatment and pathology reports typically involves a few steps, and this may differ by the facility that you're receiving treatment, but first contact the healthcare provider or facility where you're receiving treatment or where the pathology tests were conducted. And this can be either a hospital, a clinic, or a laboratory. Most healthcare facilities have a medical records department or a similar administrative office, so you can contact them either by phone, email, or in person to request copies of your reports. Or if you also have a patient portal, sometimes you're able to request your medical records there. Once you have contacted them, make sure that you provide all the necessary information. Be prepared to provide personal information such as your full name, date of birth, and other identifiers that may require to locate your records. And you may also need to provide details about the specific reports that you're requesting, such as dates of the treatments or tests. Once you've made the request, make sure to complete any required forms. So some facilities have specific forms you need to fill out to request your medical records, and these forms often require your signature, so just make sure you double check with them to see if there's any forms that you're missing that you need to complete. And once you've submitted your request, medical records departments typically process it, and again, it depends on the facility, and it may take time, so just be prepared for potential wait times. Once you receive the copies of your records, make sure you review them carefully, and if you have any questions about the content, don't hesitate to follow up with your provider for clarification. One thing to keep in mind is that there may be fees associated with obtaining copies of your medical records, so it's a good idea to inquire about any costs up front. Usually, facilities may have this information on their website. Additionally, laws and regulations regarding access to medical records may vary by location, so this does depend by the state or country where you're located, so it is essential to familiarize yourself with specific procedures and requirements in the area that you're located. You can also have your new treatment team request medical records on your behalf once you've signed a release form, so there is a step for your treatment team to request your records, so just make sure that you connect with them first. And once you've established a medical team, or even if you're newly diagnosed, it is imperative to have questions to ask your medical team prior to your appointment. And some of these questions include, what is my specific diagnosis? Have you treated other patients with my type of cancer? Where is the cancer located? What type of testing is needed for my specific diagnosis? What are my treatment options? What is the recommended treatment? Are there clinical trials available, and can you provide information about that? How long does it take for the treatment to usually last? What are the possible side effects of treatment? Should I get a second opinion? What stage is my cancer, and what are the different types of stages, and what would this mean for myself? If something unexpected comes up, who can I call? What is the best time to call you if I have a question? Would I be able to continue working while I'm undergoing treatment? What are the potential side effects and will my appearance change? What will my energy levels be like during treatment? And should I avoid any foods or have a certain diet while undergoing treatment? And lastly, it is important to ask, do I have access to supportive services such as social workers, patient navigators, psychologists, and how can I connect with them? Oftentimes, facilities have these services and you may have to be referred. So it is important to contact or connect with your oncologist directly. And again, you could also see it in the webpage to see if they have any information about what type of services they provide. Please remember that finding the best care for cancer treatment is a highly individualized process, and what works best for one person may not be the best option for another. Trust your instincts, gather as much information as possible, and advocate for yourself or your loved ones through the cancer journey. You deserve to have the best possible cancer care. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Germello. That was a wonderful presentation. And I think you covered a lot of topics. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, just very comprehensive and incredibly well done. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is former founding director of Cancer Support Services, Continuing Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System, author and researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing your important role in shared decision making, tips to communicate with your healthcare team to determine if they are the best team for you, key questions to ask your healthcare team about your treatment plan, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, guidelines to improve appointments with your healthcare team, including prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you for everybody who has tuned into this call. The issue of diversity and how it affects us in cancer treatment and diagnosis and treatment is a very, very interesting one. I've been asked to cover a number of topics, really trying to help figure out, is this the right place to be treated and are these the right providers to treat me? So I have a story to tell about how this became so important to me and my treatment team, in that we were treating a number of patients for head and neck cancer who had grown up in rural areas and surprisingly without refrigeration. And they hadn't grown up with a number of dairy products. And many of the supplements that are used during treatment for head and neck cancer in order to keep up your weight and keep up your muscles have milk proteins in them, which people could not tolerate. And it really opened my eyes to the idea that you really have to figure out a little bit more about sort of where people are coming from, what groups they belong to, are there any sort of idiosyncrasies or special characteristics about that group that we need to be aware of to treat people properly and give them the best shot at having a good response to their care? So a number of things that I've learned over the years is to first ask friends, relatives, members in the community, if anybody of the group that you identify with has been treated in this facility. Sometimes we don't have a choice of going anywhere we want based upon our insurance. So obviously you start with your insurance coverage and see what your choices are. Are members of the group you identify with are always treated there or routinely treated there? And if you can't find out from the people in your immediate circle, sometimes, and if you have a chance, it pays to branch out even more. Churches, synagogues, mosques, anybody in your social circle, even looking online. The trouble with looking online is that you don't know how good the information is, and sometimes there's bad information online. So that, I would say, would be a last resort. It should be a personal recommendation from the people who you trust. When you get to the treatment facility and cancer center and you, of course, given a whole lot of paperwork, which you're asked to fill out in the waiting room. Hopefully some of that would be completed in advance, but that varies place by place. Look around and see if there are other people who, in the group you identify, who are there too. You can also ask your providers, how much experience have you had treating blank, blank, blank cancer in my blank, blank, blank group? And see what their reaction is. It's very helpful to have people experienced in the kind of cancer you have and are familiar culturally with the group that you're in. It's very helpful, really, really helpful to have that done. So like for everybody else, we always advocate thinking through a list of questions in advance. What you need to know, and try to put them in priority order, because sometimes all questions can't get answered in a consult visit or first visit. Most of the time, they can. But make sure that you know which ones you really need to know about before leaving that day. And taking a written list in is fine. Sometimes people take what we call a scribe or a relative or a friend, who's trusted, who can write down the answers, because there's a lot of information. Some of it can be quite technical, and it's good to have an extra pair of ears who can then review it with you later. You can look things up. But I believe that your treatment team and the people who are you're seeing at the consult should be able to put things in a kind of plain spoken language that everybody can understand. And if you don't understand the word, please be sure to ask. And this is not just sort of a guideline for patients from diverse groups, but it really is for everybody. Ask your questions. It may not be get an answer right away, but ask the question and use the members of the oncology team, not just the physician, to make sure that these questions are answered. One of the other things that's come up over the last few years with the electronic medical record is having the ability to look at a good deal of your own record online. They're called electronic health records or electronic medical records. There are a number of different systems in use in the United States and across the world. These can be very helpful. You can double-check appointments. You can make appointments. You can find out when blood tests are scheduled, if you need to be fasting or not fasting for them. But they also present problems. The problems are specifically because of when the Healthcare Portability and Privacy Act was passed years ago. Portability was the idea they had in mind that the information could go from one system to another. That doesn't really happen a lot these days with all the different systems that are owned by different companies. But the idea that you would have access to your information really did happen. And it's problematic because often the information that you have access to, your providers have not even seen yet. So if you see pathology reports, imaging studies, x-rays, CAT scans, sonograms, MRIs, PET CATs, any of the other imaging studies that are done, lab reports, urine reports, please make sure that you have help in deciphering and understanding exactly what those mean. Sometimes, or most of the time, especially with lab reports, there's a column for the result and the column with a range of normal. Many times, especially during cancer treatment, some of those values are supposed to be out of the range of normal. And if they're not, that's something that needs adjustment by the treatment team. These are quite scary to read sometimes, especially the pathology reports or the imaging studies. They are very difficult to understand unless you are really experienced with them. And you may have friends or family with medical backgrounds and nursing backgrounds that can help. But because things have gotten so technical recently, it's really important to have somebody help you interpret it and understand what it means to you. And that's often somebody from your treatment team. So if you get a report that says something on the top, like not yet reviewed by your care team, please message them, depending upon how you're supposed to contact them. Call in, make a telephone appointment, and say that you need somebody to answer some questions on the phone, and often that would mean a call back. But it's very, very confusing to interpret these things yourself. You can jump to a lot of bad conclusions. So make sure that somebody is helping you understand what these tests mean and what they mean for you in your particular circumstance. So those are the topics that I was asked to cover today, and I'll turn the call back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was very comprehensive, a lot of good information for people, and perhaps very importantly, to be sure to work with your healthcare team, come prepared with your list of questions, very important. So thank you so much. And I am just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. It just celebrated its 80th year in existence, so it's been around for 80 years. And it provides a host of services. Most people call us in the United States from on our hope line at 1-800-813-4673. And those that hope line is staffed by about 40 MSW oncology social workers, and they will address your questions. So when people call, they usually have a question or concern. And then after their question or concern is answered, they might want some help with transportation, or they may want to get some counseling services or support. Then our social worker will go through all the different services we offer. So what are they? We offer practical and financial assistance and co-payment assistance, which is very vitally important to people with the cost of course, medical care as it is, and with people sometimes not having extensive health coverage. So that's a very important service that we offer. We're not the only organization that offers this, so we can also refer people to other places as well. But we also can provide very specific financial assistance when they call us. We also do offer online support groups, and they are for every age group, every type of cancer, and also for older adults, younger adults, caregivers, partners, LGBTQ community. So we have groups for everyone. So you might want to go to our website, www.cancercare.org, and you can see all the different services and particularly the support groups that we offer. In addition, we do offer these workshops, about 80 per year, again, on different types of cancers or different topics. And we also archive them as podcasts, so you can go to our website, again, and you can see all the programs that are available. And we do offer closed caption on all the podcasts so that you can actually see that as well. And we also have a lot of publications and fact sheets as well. So lots of information that you can get from Cancer Care, and there's lots of other things that you'll be able to see on our website. So that gives you just a thumbnail sketch of the services we offer, which are free. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question from Ms. Germello. I would like to ask for a second opinion on my treatment and started looking into other oncologists in my area, but I'm having a hard time finding anyone who is in my health insurance network. What is the best way to navigate this?
And thank you so much for your question. And this is also something that I often hear about in the helpline. And one of the things that you can do, and I'm not sure if this is you've done this before, but inquiring with your insurance directly to see if there's any referrals, but also if any comprehensive cancer centers nearby, even if like transportation is an issue. Oftentimes, inquiring about financial assistance programs, a lot of cancer centers have financial assistance programs, and sometimes you have to inquire. So if there aren't any in the nearby area, trying to look at some treatment centers that are around that are specifically for specific cancers, but also inquiring with other nonprofit organizations that provide financial assistance. Transportation may be the main need, especially if it's not in the nearby area. So looking into your insurance to see if they can provide you with a list, or also looking into cancer centers that may not be as nearby you, but may provide some type of financial assistance that can be helpful.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. And this question for Dr. Scout. As a transgender man, female to male, with breast cancer, I am having an identity crisis. I never felt like a woman, so how do I cope with having this disease and holding on to who I feel I am?
You know, it's a great question, and actually, I'd also like to invite you, if you're interested, to contact us directly, scout@cancer-network.org, because we're doing some work to raise awareness around this point. But there's, you know, a fair number of us who've had cancers with our discordant body parts, which are things we don't think we have in the first place. First thing I'd say is I would consider that you have chest cancer, not breast cancer, and that may be something to kind of help us, like, reframe to help you understand that. You know, everybody does have natal breasts, as it were. We just only think of them as being on women. But both guys and women have breasts. Just guys usually refer to it as their chest instead, but very similar body parts. And, you know, there's no magic cure for understanding how we can deal with our, you know, gender dysmorphia and things like that. But you can just continue to give yourself a lot of grace, including the idea that you should be in care where people are referring to you by, I presume if your pronouns are he, that people are referring to you as he all the way through care. And, you know, think of yourself as, you know, there are other guys who also get chest cancer. And that's the group you're in. It really is, you know, your natal body parts are not your current identity. So just keep thinking about those ways that you can reinforce and reaffirm your current identity and make sure your providers are doing it as well.
Oh, excellent. And another question for you, Dr. Scott. Can you discuss intersectionality and how that impacts care?
We know that every time you are part of multiple groups that experience discrimination, then that means, you know, you're never sure, are people treating me poorly because of this or because of that, but your chance of being treated poorly absolutely goes up. And then all of the different stereotypes people are going to have about the different groups you're part of all add together in their minds, and they could be giving you differential care based upon all those things. It also means that you're walking in with different sets of experiences that you're familiar with, not just our own experiences we bring to the table, but those of our family, our friends, our neighbors, and our community members, whether, you know, our family might be a racial ethnic minority with us, but community members, if, for example, if, you know, we're Muslim or something like that, may be a different group of people potentially. So, you know, all of those things really shape what apprehensions we come to the table with, and it shapes the way people treat us too. And none of that stuff is usually on the table. So in each of these cases, it really is, again, be thinking about it, consider how you can give yourself grace, and consider how when you need to advocate yourself, you can find and rally the resources in order to advocate yourself. Because we can all smell disrespect really clearly, and we can also smell respect. And if you're in a place where you feel like you're respected, then some of those issues related to intersectionality and all the historic discrimination that you're walking in with start to fade a little bit farther in the background. And that's what we all need in order to get the best chance for care and for surviving and for being thriving as we go through that.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That's really incredibly helpful. Thank you. And also, we are going to give information about Dr. Scout's organization, his email address, all the information he gave us, and we will be providing that also. When you get the SurveyMonkey evaluation at the end of the program, it will include also resources that are mentioned during the program, even some that were not, so that you're sure to feel armored with all this information. Okay, so thank you so much. And this question is from Ms. Germello. Do you know of any organizations or programs that work to help people with disabilities in rural areas? I have a really hard time transporting myself to and from my appointments and have had to reschedule appointments because I could not find someone to bring me. If you could comment on that. That's a common issue for us at Cancer Care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage you to give us a call if you are in the United States, as, you know, knowing a little bit more information about your specific needs can really help us gather a comprehensive list of resources that are tailored to what you need. But there are, you know, and you can also go on our website, cancercare.org. We have a lot of resources. If you look, we have a specific diagnostic, option where you can click on a diagnosis. You could also click on a specific topic, and you can go through our helping hand, which is a list of resources with all the states in alphabetical order. So there's a lot of organizations out there. Cancer Care is one of them. We do provide services and financial assistance. So definitely, if you are in the United States, give us a call, and we can assist you in gathering some resources.
And Ms. Sherrill, do you want to comment on our resource navigation team, because they also could be of use here too?
Yeah, absolutely. So once you contact the helpline, we will provide an overview of all services, but the resource navigation program specifically is you will be connected to a resource navigator, and you will share with them the barriers that you're having, so whether it's transportation or assistance with co-pays or any general assistance, you know, whether it's for general bills or rent. And then our resource navigators will go ahead and do a search of resources that may be helpful, resources that may be in your area, and then you are in charge of connecting with those resources, and then you can connect back to the resource navigator, and you can share with them, you know, this was helpful, this wasn't helpful, and they could also provide you with steps on how to reach out to those organizations. It can be really overwhelming having to reach out to organizations, but the great thing about resource navigation is that you have someone that can guide you on how to do it and provide you the resources that you need specifically to, you know, the request that you're having or the challenges that you're having.
Well, thank you so much. And for Dr. Scott, mental health services in my culture are traditionally not spoken about and even frowned upon, but I know that it is important to seek care. Can you provide any advice on how to come to terms and start this process of seeing someone or going to support groups?
Oh, you know, it's a good point, and there's a bunch of cultures where that's the case. We certainly see that in a lot of the Middle East cultures, some of the African cultures, things like that. And I think what we understand from behavior change actually is that the more we surround ourselves with people who have kind of the new thing that we're trying to move for behavior change on, whether that's marathon running or whether that's going to a support group, the easier it becomes for us. So I would think that in your life, do you have anybody who may come from a different cultural background where that value is different that you can kind of think about leaning into and talking to more about this? It's just a little bit of a brain hack that we want to be kind of in the middle of a group. So if we have a group that's, you know, going to a different goal than what we started with, that helps us naturally want to get to the middle of it. So think about if you've got any people that have a different set point on that. And then, you know, even if you don't, think about you're doing a great job of self-talk, of being aware of what your barrier is and being aware of what the goal is, and then realizing you have to, like, cross that chasm to get to something that's going to be good for you. So maybe it's just more of that self-talk of, like, you know, something for myself, for my health, because it's been proven, I'm going to try 3 different support groups. It's going to be scary. I may not talk to people in my own culture about it because I won't get support there. But maybe I'll talk with some these other people who would value it, and I'll be gentle on myself because I know I am trying to cross that cultural chasm, but I'm doing it for my health.
Wow, that's great. That's so now we come to a point now where I actually ask, I'm going to ask both Dr. Scout and Ms. Jarmello to provide just a takeaway to the audience. So it could be a 2 minutes or a minute a thing you'd like people to take away from today's program as an important point. So I'm going to start with Dr. Scout.
We are trained to think that doctors are experts who hold hidden information that they will eke out to us, and that we should put up with how they treat us. But if we can reframe our head more to think that doctors should be your partners who treat you with great dignity, respect, and bring you into the decision-making process whenever possible, that will help us realize that we should be getting a better standard of care and realize when we might need to say goodbye to some of our healthcare providers and what kinds of healthcare providers we need to look for.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's really wonderful. And Ms. Jarmello?
Yeah, in I would say that it can be really overwhelming, especially if you're newly diagnosed or you've never dealt with a cancer diagnosis before. And so having a support community or a community that's supportive to you, whether it's friends, family, spirituality, or even, you know, if you don't have a support, that means that your medical team will be your support, which means that you should feel comfortable. You should feel heard and understood. And so it can be overwhelming, but just starting by asking for help in any way, right, whether it's a social worker, whether you reach out to a nonprofit organization like Cancer Care or any other organizations that are out there, that can be your first step in feeling less alone, having some support that can help you guide you through this time.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I also just want to comment that actually the SurveyMonkey will be sent out in a few days. So just stand by. You'll be getting it in a few days. And I actually want to thank our speakers who've really been incredible on today's program, just an incredible speakers today. And I also want to thank all of our participants on the call today, because you really, we've done a program like this before, but I have to say today the questions are really, you really asked such really great questions, and our speakers, of course, were just phenomenal answering them as well. However, I do want to comment, because there were so many of you on the call today, we couldn't take everyone's question, so I do want to comment about the questions. First of all, if you had a chance to ask a question, if you have a question in queue, or if you have a question that you'd like to ask, please, all of you, go back to Treating Healthcare Team and ask them the question, because you've learned things today, and so you may ask the question slightly differently, and you may hear the answer slightly differently, too. And if you don't like, if your healthcare provider isn't providing the answer to your question, then you have to think about, what do I do? Do I ask the question again? Do I clarify with them what I was looking for in their answer? So you get a little bit more information because you really want that question answered. And because they have access to your healthcare team, or your healthcare records and everything, they know a bit more about you, of course, than we do today on the program today. They know a lot more about you because we don't have your records in front of us to check, you know, to see what, we haven't been seeing you regularly. So that's an important thing. Also, most importantly, it's really important to know how to access your healthcare team. It seems on evenings, weekends, and holidays. That seems to be the time when it's really hard for people to reach their healthcare team. So be sure that you have a number to call weekends, holidays, evenings, because those seem to be the time. Things seem to be, during the day, usually someone answers the phone in most practices. And then also, I just want to thank all of you for participating on today's program. We will have many more programs coming your way, so you'll be hearing about more of them. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.